Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Spin the Rally Pod, reporting for duty once again. Hello and thanks for downloading. Now, first up, I should point out we are leaving the petrol heads behind us for this episode, as we are instead going renewable and off-road ahead of the first round of the Extreme E Championship. I'm Lisa O'Sullivan, eager to embrace the new age of motorsporting excellence, and I'm delighted to be joined by an exciting bunch of brains helping me and you get up to speed on this brand new adventure. We've got Dirtfish's resident extreme experts Anna Duxbury and Dominic Wild. We've also got Spin's very own technological guru, former team boss George Donaldson. And heading out of quarantine very shortly in Saudi Arabia and off to the service park, or should that be service boat, is Dirtfish.com senior staff writer David Evans. David, good morning. Good morning the rest of you. But David, how's the sand?
Well, Lise, I have to say I haven't actually seen any. I've seen the inside of a hotel room for the last 2.5 days. And I've got one day left. Actually, that's not true. So I did head out this morning to go and get a coronavirus test, which was quite the most aggressive test I've had. And I've had quite a few aggressive tests. I think the bloke was essentially playing darts with the thing into the back of my throat, which was quite a lively start to the day. And you did tell us, Lise, to turn off, phones in flight mode. That is, I'm afraid, a bit of a no-no here, because if I do that, and I did that by mistake, we have kind of a COVID tracking app out here, which is keeping an eye on us all to make sure that none of us have coronavirus or whatever. But as soon as I went into the flight mode, it flashed a warning saying, don't do this, turn it back on. Ooh. So I'm rather more afraid of the Saudi COVID police than I am of you. So I will be leaving it on, if that's
fair
all right.
Enough, fair enough. That's fine by me. We should at this point, of course, welcome our Extreme E experts, the Dirtfish debutantes. Anna, good morning. Dom, good morning. Welcome to the Spin the Rally Pod.
Good morning.
I am so excited about Extreme E. It's something that we've kind of touched the edges of, haven't we, boys, in Spin the Rally Pod. But I think we really need to get to grips with the minutiae of the championship for people that are tuning in who might not quite know how it works. Let's start. Anna, perhaps, can you tell us, how is this new championship set up? How's it going to work?
So it's a really exciting new concept, really. We've got this series that's a mixture of sort of Dakar and Rallycross and even like W Series. It's got sort of everything thrown at it here. It's another classic, a gag type series. We've got the electric cars, which obviously is a big thing. But we've also got this element of the compulsory female driver and compulsory male driver, for that matter, in each team, each of which will do one lap in each two-lap race. So they have equal balance there, sort of in the results. We've sort of got everything thrown at this series. It's a really exciting new concept.
Now, Dominic, it's the cars obviously are going to be the star in this championship to start with, maybe, because before we get to grips with everything that's happening on the team side of things, tell us a little bit about what kind of cars are going to be featuring in the championship.
Yeah, so it's a one-make series, at least at first. All the cars being built by Spark in France, the same company that built the Formula E cars, or still does build the Formula E cars, I should say. It's a little over 1.5 tons. 540 horsepower, all-wheel drive. If you've seen the car in person, it's been on display at Goodwood and Autosport International back when we were allowed to leave the house.
I remember those days.
It feels like a long time ago, doesn't it? Yeah, it's a big thing. It's you think of racing cars as being quite small. This kind of isn't. It's massive. But yeah, one make series, teams can sort of tweak the bodywork a little bit, but all the powertrain underneath is completely identical, so the racing is going to be as close as ever. A battery produced by Williams Advanced Engineering, who obviously is an offshoot of the Formula One team as well, and a tubular steel frame chassis as well. So it's we talk about how modern it is, but at the same time, it's very simple. It's very off, like a true off-road truck that we see in the States as well.
George, what do you think about the cars that they got?
Well, they're absolutely amazing. As Dom said, they're big, they're wide. You know, they're big, wide cars. They're stable. They're built to be stable. The idea is that they can be thrashed through the type of Baja 500, which is the easiest thing to envisage. Extreme E is an electric version of a Baja type anything goes event, except with these unique Extreme E concepts of where we're going in the world, and it's a world championship. Let's make no mistake about that. 550 horsepower equivalent, 400 kilowatts, instant torque. The interesting thing for me, sitting here as a team manager right now, is the strategy that you would implement before the event and the tactics. The tactics are all about communication in the car. So we've got two drivers in the car. One will be, you've got drivers like Carlos Sainz, Sebastian Loeb, dozens of years worth of rally experience, which will translate very well into Extreme E. Of course, Dakar drivers would probably be even better, but let's make no mistake, Carlos and Sebastian both with that Dakar experience. So we're going in there with a wealth of knowledge. Their partners, I don't know so much about them, but that will all be, and this is the key strategic element for me, is the communication between those drivers, the experienced drivers and the less experienced drivers, whether it's women or men or men and women, it doesn't make any difference. But they'll all be very competent, very, very astute drivers, very skilled. But the experience that those guys can impart across to their partners will be the difference between winning and losing over two laps. It's going to be very exciting.
I want to come back to that in a bit. But David, we mentioned you're out in Saudi Arabia and, you know, both, and well, everyone has mentioned that it is a very much a world championship. How is this different from other championships that travel the world? I jokingly said that you're heading off to the service boat later.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right, Lise. You know, one of the absolute premises of this championship is that it's designed to shine a light on areas that are climatically challenged. So, you know, we're here in Saudi Arabia to look at the process of kind of desertification. I'm now reading from some notes I made, but 12 million hectares of land each year are lost because of drought. And obviously carbon dioxide has a big impact on that. So running electric vehicles is huge. But actually moving the nine teams and all of the mechanical parts, everything around the world is done by on the HMS Elena, which is formerly a Royal Mail boat that went from somewhere to somewhere, I think in the South Pacific. I can't remember exactly.
St. Helena. It'd be St. Helena. St. Helena.
Yes. St. Helena. Yeah, it went.
Will it be? Yeah. Is it definitely?
What did I say?
Yeah.
You went from somewhere to somewhere.
Yeah.
Very, very astutely, I thought,
somewhere,
David.
Somewhere in the... Hang on, I've just found the right page. Right, so RMS St. Helena is capable of running on one engine. It runs on low sulfur marine diesel, which apparently is less bad than... Yeah, because Georgie, normal diesel that you'd put in a ship is pretty much crude oil, isn't it? I mean, it's horrible stuff.
It's pretty much, it's absolutely disgusting. It's the worst of the worst. It really is. It needs to be heated to be able to flow. It's just tar, basically.
So this low sulfur thing, that's quite a big deal, isn't it?
It'll be running. You know, Euro 4 or Euro 5 diesel, probably. You know, it'll be proper diesel engines in it.
That's exactly what I thought. So that boat that used to ship mail from somewhere to somewhere, I'll get back to you on that to tell you exactly where and where it was, has been totally transformed, and the build cost was 32 million. Its home port is Liverpool, and essentially everything that is to do with Extreme E is on that boat, including, I think there's 60-odd cabins where the team members can sleep. And it sailed from Liverpool in late February to Saudi, to where are we going next? Senegal, then to Greenland, to Brazil, and finally down to Patagonia for the last round in December. So, you know, immediately you've had a massive impact on not having to air freight stuff around the world. But, you know, you can't underestimate the massive concept of Extreme E that is to demonstrate essentially where we've gone wrong in burning fossil fuels and to demonstrate a way forward for motorsport. It's, you know, it's about motorsport and entertainment showing what we've got to do to get the world back on track, essentially.
But it's okay to be excited about a new motorsport championship, isn't it? Makes you feel a bit kind of odd, doesn't it? Or is that just me, Anna?
No, Lise, can I just jump in there? Sorry, not for the first time, I'm sure. Apologies for this. but that's exactly my point. You know, I've read all of this stuff about, you know, what we're doing to save the planet and all that. And you kind of feel like, wow, that should really be getting me dead excited, and it does a little bit. But actually, fundamentally, what I'm really excited about is seeing these cars with essentially 550 horsepower, you know, the likes of Johan Kristoffersen and you know, incredible driver, you know, Johan Kristoffersen, Molly Taylor, Jenson Button, all of these people thrown into a completely new format of racing. And we spoke yesterday briefly with Timo Scheider, who's the guy who is one of the kind of course experts out here in Saudi. He drove the circuit for the track, whatever we're going to call it. You know, it's a lap of about 5 miles or something for the first time yesterday, and was so excited about it. It is completely new. And as much as we're all very virtuous, like you say, and interested in the environment, we're all electro-petrol heads, whatever, and we're all looking forward to racing.
Dom, Anna, just jump in whenever you like. What's most exciting you two about this? Because you are our dirtfish experts on Extreme E.
I think for me, it's got to be the sheer range of drivers. I mean, you expect to see people like Carlos Sainz and Sebastian Loeb in an off-road racing championship. But then you've got some of the top guys and girls from off-road truck racing in America. You've got people, like David said, Molly Taylor from Australia coming over. Jenson Button's here. You know, he's a guy who's talked about off-road racing his whole life, but we know him as an F1 driver. So it's just the sheer variety and the diverse driver roster, for me, that's incredible. I mean, we think that there's a good driver lineup at something like Race of Champions, but that's a one-off throwaway event. This is a real serious series, and these guys and girls are going to be racing all throughout the year, and it's gonna, how many times have we had this pub conversation where, you know, rally drivers are the best drivers in the world. No, Formula One drivers are the best drivers in the world. Well, now we get to find out, because everyone from all walks of motorsport life, as it were, are coming together. They're all racing the same cars on the same tracks, and, you know, may the best driver win.
Yeah, like the guys have said, really, it quite literally is a race of champions. We've got people from all over the place, and we do get to see them head to head, quite aside from the electric nature of the series. And we've got these great drivers with an unusual, quite complex format of racing, and it'll be really exciting to see, because we quite literally don't know who's going to come out on top here. I think that really is the exciting thing.
Anna just mentioned just one sec, Lee. Sorry, Anna, can you tell us a little bit about the format? I am chucking you under the bus a little bit here, because I've got an idea. There's qualifying, semis.
Get used to it, Anna.
Yeah, sorry.
I made some quite extensive notes on this last night, because it is very complicated and I'm still getting my head around it. But basically, on the Saturday, we've got two qualifying sessions, each of which will contain two races, which in my head would make more sense to call it four qualifying sessions, but never mind. and in each of those races, the finishing position of the races in the first qualifying will guarantee your starting positions in the second qualifying. And the results of all of these will take you into Sunday, when you'll have the semi-final one and semi-final two for the lower half of the grid, which is being called the Crazy Race, which promises more than it may deliver. top four from your first semi-final and... No, sorry. Top three from your first semi-final plus the top finisher in the Crazy Race will go through to the final. And the grid for that, excitingly, is going to be decided by grid play. So that's going to be by the fans and also, strangely, by the other teams who have to decide where to allocate their votes that they've received from fans if they don't make it through to the final.
That's
this
right.
It's more complicated than the rugby league
that's
end
bizarre.
Of the season.
No, but the grid play thing is actually quite cool. So if you're a fan out there, just as you could have an impact on Formula E with, I think, was it in Formula E that you could vote for who got that extra bit of power or something for a wee while? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Something like that. So,
but
so
this is a whole other step.
It is, isn't it? Because suddenly, you know, you can give somebody the chance. And Anna, just explain how the teams...
Actually, it's very clever because you're trying to get the word out about the championship, because the bigger number of fans you have engaging with you as a team, the more clout you're going to have.
Yeah, exactly. But the interesting bit that Anna touched on there is obviously all of the teams, all nine teams, will get a percentage of the vote, but only, I think, do we have five in the final? I can't remember.
Four, I believe.
Four. So there will be five teams out there who don't get through, but have a percentage of that vote. So they then will give their vote to one of those four teams. So again, George, you know, we're going to see bizarrely some team strategy. Could you ever imagine, George, when you were sporting director at Subaru, giving an advantage to Peugeot or somebody else?
It would be a cold day in hell. It really would. But it's so interesting when you look at the mix. You know, you've got Carlos Sainz and Laia Sanz, different. But they're both Spanish. So you. But then you've got German and Swedish. You've got British and Swedish. You've got British and Australian. You've got Spanish and British. So even that if the fans are all coming from one region, they're gonna be drawn all over the place. So I think it's going to be an absolutely world championship. In that, I don't think it's going to be possible to have national preferences parlaying into what happens. Hopefully, the fans that are watching will do it just purely on the performance and the value and the feedback that we're getting, you know, via the live feeds to the fans, you know, an engagement. So it should be super interesting, but it's all going to be down to how well the stronger drivers can coax the weaker drivers in the team to go fast, to not lift, to push.
So what you're saying is it's going to turn into Eurovision for cars then, with like the Swedish drivers voting for the Finnish drivers.
Ultimately, again, Dom, I mean, it's down to the fact, you know, is it going to be dusty? Is it going to be possible to pass? You know, I mean, these tracks, you know, it's only a 5 mile lap. You'll have to configure it. So, you know, presumably there'll be some straight sections and it'll be wider and you can crack on. Will it be faster to stay in someone's tracks? Will there be a cleaner line? Or if you go on to, say, fresh sand, is it faster? I don't know. I tell you one thing's for sure, Carlos Sainz and Sebastian Loeb will know, and anyone else that's done Dakar, the Baja guys will know, the American drivers, if they've all done Bajas, they'll know. The Swedes, well, they're all, half of them are rallycross. I mean, Jenson Button's maybe at a slight disadvantage here. But his co-driver, I don't know much about Michaela Kotelinski, but if her mother is the previous Kotelinski driver that used to drive the factory Volvos, imagine a factory Volvo rally car. It does exist. It did exist. Great heritage there.
And she did an awful lot of testing, I think. She did. Dom or Anna, sorry, was she the Continental Tire tester, was she?
She
yes.
was the original tester, yeah.
Yeah,
so she's not done as much testing recently, but she has got that background that should give her a bit of an advantage.
Yeah, yeah.
Can we talk about the inclusion of the women in this championship? Because it has, you know, some people have said, well, it's just tokenism or whatever, but it's a fantastic opportunity to promote women drivers who have always struggled to be given the opportunity to prove themselves. And as you've mentioned, George, this championship could be decided by the team that makes a strength of its weaknesses, as it were, is able to develop them on. So how important is it, do you think, that we actually start seeing more women coming into motorsport? Extreme E just seems to have been able to prop the door open.
Well, full marks to them for managing this. And I mean, what they've created is that's a team, like a driver and a co-driver, with the added mix that they both have to drive and they both have to co-drive. Now, obviously, in terms of co-driving, you don't need pace notes for a 5-mile circuit. 8 kilometres, you learn that. Now, I assume that there's a recce. Dom, Anna, keep me right if we're not. Very quick interjection required. Is there recce? Is there not?
There's a course walk.
I think there's going to be a track walk, yeah.
It's a course walk. Well, that's a long walk, isn't it?
It's a very long walk.
This is not athletics. What's going on here? Okay,
it's concerning me, George. Trust me, the media involvement.
George's idea of a long walk was from the car to the hot ferme.
Okay. So, actually, okay, that's fine. It's a walk. So, yes, you will, as you walk, you will make pace notes because you're going to have to actually understand what's over the next crest, understand how sharp the next corner is, a blind corner, how wide you can go. So there will be a short note. It won't be the detailed notes that we see on WRC, but it won't be far away from it. Maybe just 3 or 4 pages, maybe 5 or 6 pages. David, you can keep us right because you'll see it firsthand. So that's got to be done across 2 languages, and it's got to be imparted in a way that, you know, I don't know, the more experienced driver goes first so he can figure out what you can do, and then he pushes the second driver to not lift through. Don't lift, keep wide, turn now, in you go. And it's imparting that experience, knowledge that the car will absorb it and make it, having the courage to not lift, having the courage to keep the wheel straight, let the car do its work. I'm sure the chassis is very good, but that'll present itself after the first event.
I think from what I can understand, the road, the circuit is quite wide. In that, you know, you're sort of told you've got to go between these certain points, between these certain markers. So there's not perhaps a sort of prescribed, defined line around the place. But for sure, you know,
how many days have you got to walk this? I mean, have you got 3 or 4 days to walk over? You know, if you're talking about a track that's 400 or 500 meters wide potentially, you want to explore different ways.
The other big question is whether David's going to go out in his long trousers and his jumper.
Yes.
You're going to fry David.
Cords.
Exactly. That's for sure. I do think that, you know, inevitably they will have to let them drive the course. They really will. I can't imagine, you know, that.
Maybe they send them out in golf buggies.
Yeah, also all the desert equivalent or whatever. But one thing is for sure, it will be very, very dusty. Looking out the window now, it is very sunny, with absolutely no sign of any rain coming at all. And the Aluna.
Well, but if it's sand doesn't dust, you know, it's only dust that dusts. So if it's proper sand, then it won't dust. But presumably there's a mix. Are we in the mountains where you are? Is it?
No. When I first arrived, I could see a mountain, but it's disappeared behind the sand or dust or dusty sand. Or whatever it is.
Okay, right. I stand corrected. There is dust then. Okay.
One question I did want to ask about it's a one-make championship. We've got the same cars. Will the mechanics make a difference? Could we see the teams with the cleverest mechanics, as we've seen before, the clever use of different ways of putting tyres on cars and, as in different patterns, not obviously putting them on in a unique fashion. Can mechanics make a difference in this championship?
I think that's quite a really interesting point, because while I can't speak for every team, I know that Chip Ganassi Racing, Kyle LeDuc brought his off-road racing truck crew with him to serve as the crew on the Extreme E team. So while a lot of teams will be learning on the fly about big off-road vehicles, Chip Ganassi Racing at least have a head start in that regard. So whether or not they will affect things over the course of the season, I don't know. One of the rally guys will be able to answer that better. But I think at least going into round one, those that have got experience with these particular types of vehicles, I think it's hard to say that they won't have a bit of a leg up on the competition.
I think you're right there, Dom. I'd spoken briefly with Sainz about the car when he first tested it, and he said, you know, there's not as much variation. You can't work on the setup as much as you would want to. But, you know, Carlos is at a bit of an extreme, as you will testify, George. You know, Carlos Sainz is a driver who would test until the cows came home and then test a bit more. And it will be quite alien, won't it, to him not to be able to run through a range of setup before he gets in the car.
Yeah, and there's where Chip Ganassi might have a little bit of an advantage, because even something as simple as a tyre pressure being 3 or 4 PSI, you know, 0.1, 0.2 of a bar difference, can make a massive difference in the way that the car's going to handle and the way it's going to get traction. And I'm sure we will be, at least as the whole thing progresses and progresses through the heats, we'll see it, you know, in the tenths and even hundredths will make a difference. Especially if you can go slightly different ways, you know, it's going to be tough.
I think as well, Dom, you mentioned Chip Ganassi and talked about them there, and Kyle Duggan and Sarah Price. For me, you know, they could almost be, it's very unfair to call them dark horses, but they're the ones, you know, they're not coming in with a whole bunch of world championships, but they are coming in with massive experience of off-road racing and driving this kind of thing. And, you know, I think, Anna, you mentioned that, you know, there are so many drivers coming in from different areas. You know, how is Jenson Button going to fare when he turns this thing into the first corner? You know, he's done some testing. He's done some testing in Wales. But it's a whole world away from where we are right now. And this is the fascinating thing, is that there are, you know, so many drivers, the likes of Stefan Sarrazin, you know, just not much experience. And the one thing that I would like to say, actually, is one of the things that I've been really surprised about is the one guy in all of electric off-road motorsport right now that seems to, you know, have a real advanced understanding of the engineering and how to drive these cars is Hayden Padden. And I'm really surprised that Hayden didn't get picked up by one of the teams. You know, I was talking to him a month or so ago about how to drive an electric rally car. And he said, you know, it is a completely different mindset. You know, for example, you've got no engine braking at all. You know, I'm sure in his car, you can set the energy recovery quite harshly. So it does essentially, or it will act as an engine brake. But I don't know if you can do that in these. So that was just one thing that I felt I should share, that I do think that everybody's favorite Kiwi has been overlooked.
And one thing as well that we kind of briefly touched upon, but we haven't really spoken in much detail, is communication between drivers as well. I mean, other than the Ganassi guys and the Sainz guys, you've got multiple nationalities and multiple backgrounds. So you've got to find this common ground, not just of language, but of terminology as well. Now, when I spoke to Kyle LeDuc a few months ago, he was saying that they kind of skipped all that because both he and Sarah Price have done off-road truck racing and things like Baja. So, you know, they use the same words for the same things. So they didn't need to sort of learn each other's language, as it were. They already had that nailed down, and you'll have Sainz and Sands who will have the same advantage, both coming from Dakar as well. But then when you look at something, a team like Veloce, for example, you've got Stefan Sarrazin, who's driven everything, and then Jamie Chadwick, who's very much a circuit racer. You know, they're going to have to learn, you know, what words mean what for certain things. And there's going to be this sort of, I don't mean a literal language barrier, but sort of a motorsport language barrier, if you will. And teams are going to have to overcome that so they can find sort of how to communicate both on track and off track as well.
Definitely going to be a key factor for me, that is, Dom, 100%.
Again, maybe that's a strength for the rally teams or those coming from a rally background, because it has always been a bit of a United Nations in a lot of the teams, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking down the list there. Seb Loeb, Stefan Sarrazin, And obviously, Carlos, not that it's an issue for him with his country woman with him, but I'm sure that all these guys will communicate perfectly. It's a fairly simple vocabulary. It's a 5 mile circuit, 8 kilometers. You know, you're going to work that one out. You'll have worked it out long before you get to Saudi Arabia. You'll fine tune it as you go around the track. I'm sure. I mean, if that was me, I would have been out practicing with my driver, but my co-driver, anywhere at all, any roads, any tracks. So, you know, if they've got the resource, not that we've necessarily got the ability in lockdown to go out to some desert areas and just create some roads and get that nomenclature sorted out, figure it out. It's very, very brief. It's very simple and fast, slow, stop, flat out.
Yeah. You know. I did forget, actually, that, of course, there's me saying that Jenson Button won't have a clue what's going to happen when he gets to the first corner. He has done, he did he not, Anna, did he do Baja or something a while ago?
He did last year, yeah.
Yeah, so he's not a complete newcomer. How did
he
do?
He broke down in the desert, didn't he? Had to spend all night there.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Yes.
Apparently it's gorgeous.
Well, that's not going to happen here because, you know, as much as it is desert racing, it's not desert racing for very far. What one thing that we do know, or another thing that we do know about the track, is that there is some undulation. From what Scheider said, there is, you know, there's quite a steep downhill section. So it does sound like it is going to be quite interesting. Unfortunately, there's still a couple of days before we actually get up there to go and have a good look around the place. But I'm sure it will be very entertaining.
I know the championship's called Extreme E, but it is a very extreme environment to kick off the championship. And then it's going to continue that way around the world. At the end of the season, it's going to be potentially the team that's been able to adapt between the extremities, isn't it? I mean, it kind of sounds obvious when I'm saying it like that, but we are going to be seeing very different conditions from race to race.
We will.
I guess that the nous will go up exponentially each event, you know, won't it?
Yeah.
It will.
So it become less of an issue as we move through it. So that makes more of a focus being very important to try and get out the box in the best way. So everyone will be desperate to do incredibly well. Strategically, it's super important not to throw anything away on this first event. Don't come back with nothing.
And essentially what they learn here, you know, from driving on the sand and the rocks here will work when they go to Senegal for the next round, which is on, you know, not dissimilar kind of terrain. But then we're off to Greenland after that and Brazil, where you kind of wonder exactly what the terrain will be like there. Do either Dom or Anna, do you know much about Greenland or Brazil or what we can expect or even Patagonia?
Go on, if you know more than me.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I didn't think they'd revealed much about it yet, but you seem to know, so go on.
No, I mean, they haven't said much at all, but I was going to say, they've given each race a key word, haven't they? Like, this is desert, Senegal's ocean, which, you know, are they going to swap the cars for powerboats? I have no idea. Greenland's Arctic, Brazil's Amazon, and Argentina's glacier. So, from these one word descriptions that we have, I think like Saudi Arabia and Senegal are likely to be similar. Greenland and Argentina are probably going to be similar as well. So the lessons learned from round three in August can probably be applied in December. But again, as Anna said, we just don't know too much yet. But that in itself's a good thing because you look at, I mean, this it is an off-road championship, but it's more circuit racing than it is rallying. And you look at things like World Rallycross or Formula One or, you know, even IndyCar and NASCAR, you go to the same venues every year, you've got data, you've got notes, you know, you've got hours of YouTube footage that you can watch. If there's nothing for us to talk about now, then there's nothing for the drivers to you know, plan with. So everyone's going to be going into every round completely blind. So what they can learn this weekend for Senegal and what they can learn in Greenland for Argentina is going to be absolutely crucial.
One one thing that is interesting that we do know is that when they've done their first lap, the race continues, and I guess they come into some sort of pit area to stop, jump out, and change seats, and then continue in the race. So one of the things that I know the crews had been quite keen on was the fact that they had sort of similar height, similar size crew. The one that stands out to me is Rosberg crew, which is Johan Kristoffersen, who is a mighty tall fella, and Molly Taylor, who's not a mighty tall lady. And do we think
I've just got a vision of her trying to hitch the seat forward? Well,
it's not a problem. It'll be seat cushions and the belts will just pull up. Nothing.
Dom and Anna, aren't I? That I'm not being completely stupid. It is all part of the race. This driver change.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah. Phew. Is there a standard time like there was in Formula E at the beginning? That's something that I've not managed.
Have you got a minute stop or something? A minute dead time?
Yeah, it must be. Right. Surely. Okay.
I would have had it on the go.
I would have done that as
but
well.
But then you've
George.
Got issues of
safety issues. Surely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's why we don't have the rolling starts in rally anymore, George.
We never had rolling starts in rally.
Sorry, I didn't mean yes.
That reminded me of a great story, which had taking us off on a slight tangent here. But when Michelle Mouton did Pikes Peak for the second time, and she fell out with the organisers of the event, and her, as her punishment, she was found guilty of speeding by 5 miles an hour on the course. Oh. So largely because our American friends didn't want a European to come over and win Pikes Peak, certainly not a European lady, they told her that when she started the race, she would have to start standing by the side of the car. She would then have to get in the car, put her belts on, and carry on. Whereas everybody else, of course, with Pikes Peak, the clock starts as you take a flying start across the start line. And Michelle quite rightly pointed out that actually she'd be in a bit of a hurry and she may not do her belts up properly. And what happens then if she has a crash at the first corner and comes out of the belts? And she was immediately, the stewards found a new way of penalising her. But no, I think we're sorry, that was quite a long and quite a pointless
story. No, God, that's really interesting. That says so much about motorsport. It says a lot about the way that women have been treated in the sport.
It does. But actually, just to finish that story, she, of course, did go on to break the course record in 1985 and showed all the Americans the way home.
Go, Michelle. She's a legend.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, let's see if the Americans show us the way home, show all the Europeans the way home on the first event here.
Yeah.
And I think it's just going to come down to drivers. It's going to come down to that teamwork and the ability to make that work. And I think there'll be one or two of them will stand out head and shoulders.
Those two guys, those two in the crew, can't call them guys. Sorry, Anna and Lisa. But Sarah and Kyle LeDuc, I think from what I can understand, you two put me right, they would have spent a bit more time perhaps together working on strategy and stuff than most of the other crews.
On that, actually, I think it's quite surprising how much time the Andretti guys have been spending together. I mean, if you follow Katie Munnings and Timmy Hansen on social media, they've been together what seems like constantly since they've been announced, you know, really working hard to nail this down. And we seem to have seen that more so from them than any other team. So, you know, it goes to show what you were saying about, you know, having to, you know, get this nailed down going into Saudi Arabia. So, yeah, the Ganassi team will have been doing that. I mean, they're the only true US-based team. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not like they can just, you know, they're not European based, and are sort of forced together in that regard. So the US guys and girls will obviously have been spending time together, but the Andretti team as well, UK based, despite being Andretti Autosport, they've been spending a heck of a lot of time together as well, working this out.
Casey told me she's spoken to Timmy every day since they've been announced, and I assume it'll be a similar situation. Across the board, really.
Mm-hmm. I'm
you would
I'm
imagine
not sure
it'd have
about
to be
that.
Like that.
But you know what, Carlos Sainz, Could we imagine Carlos being on the phone? Yeah, I'm sure he would want to be, because that's
exactly...
I'd be
texting the whole time.
But, you know, he's some of these are, you know, busy guys. And you know, Seb doing Dakar and being busy with all of that stuff. Jensen Button commentating on the Grand Prix yesterday.
I'm not getting gender-oriented here, David, but that sounds like a man's excuse. There's always time to pick up the phone and have a five-minute conversation.
That's very true. Sorry, Lisa.
Okay, Lisa, so you're the first one that's been sexist then, Lisa.
I know, it's outrageous, isn't it? Before we finish, one thing that we haven't really talked about specifically is the way these cars are being powered. And that is something that is new and could fail potentially on the circuit. We could see the cars herring around and then come to a screaming halt very suddenly, with any motorsport, obviously, you know, doesn't have to be petrol driven. But I'm curious about the way these cars are being motivated.
Okay, do you want me to pick up some in there?
Yeah.
Okay, so a new battery engineered by Williams. Okay, so that's definitely a failure point. Can be a failure point. But these cars, so the electric systems, the physical car, very strong tubular chassis, should be quite strong. All tested at Château Lestour in the south of France, an unbelievably rough place, used to be used for safari testing. So I think the cars will be quite well tested, but you never, ever get the full test as you might get on an event like this. But it is only, what are we talking, 16-kilometre lap. Two laps. I would have thought that I would be very disappointed if the homework hasn't been done, if the engineering hasn't been done to get us a reliable event. That said, you know, you can get some funny things happening with electronics in the heat. Is it hotter here? You know, is everything a little bit more heat soaked? The one thing that batteries and battery powered vehicles don't like is heat. They don't like the cold either, particularly. But the heat really, the cold will attenuate what they can do, but the heat will defeat them. So the cooling systems have got to be clever. If a cooling system fails, then the electronics will fail shortly thereafter. So yeah, there's a lot of things can go wrong, Lisa, but I'm sure they've done their homework. Château Lestour was a good place.
And they've got to be, they've been fairly brave here, because all of the coverage is, I'm sure there's a small delay, but it's all, you can watch most of it live. From pretty much in qualifying. So any issues with the cars will be broadcast around the planet immediately. But just to answer that question, Lise, of how the power is actually generated, it's coming from a hydrogen fuel cell, which through a process of electrolysis combines oxygen and hydrogen into this box, where a bit of magic happens through this thing about called electrolysis. And then you get water out of one end, which is going to be used to flush the toilets in the service park. And out of the other end, you get electricity, which is shot to the batteries and is stored in a battery somewhere and then fed into the cars. It takes 2 hours to charge the cars for 20 minutes drive time. And that is about all I've got to offer in terms of batteries, but I can whiz us back to the point earlier about the Helena, St. Helena, which went from Cape Town, Georgia, quite right, to St. Helena, and then onto the Ascension Islands to deliver post, and then back to Cape Town, and then back again to the Ascension Islands. Is anybody still there?
I'm still here, David. It was a great monologue. It was all very interesting. I was captivated.
I was hoping that Anna and Dom were going to pick up on the actual
electrolysis.
Side of the,
yeah. Well, there
David,
is,
our resident chemist.
there is a sort of propulsion-ish thing that we haven't mentioned, and this is the hyperdrive hyperboost thing.
Oh yeah.
So there's a power boost which can be activated from a button on the steering wheel. Initially, they said that would go to the team that made the biggest jump on the first lap, so it's all very Mario Kart. But that's the sort of talk around that has quietened in recent months, so I don't know whether that's still a rule and whether they've just got everyone's got a boost and they can use it as and when they please, or whether they still have this this jump competition, as it were. David, you might be able to help me on that.
No, there was definitely there was yeah, just a a bit more of a chat here that everybody's got the boost. But when right. I asked the question, nobody seemed to know how long the boost would last and where do you go into a sort of a DRS zone where you can use it, or can you use it exactly where you want? And yeah, I'd seen the same stuff about the jump as well, which seemed like a great idea. But I think that perhaps might be a little bit too Mario Kart for global motorsport.
Well, I don't know, though. We're looking at bringing a new audience into motorsport. I think you do have to kind of consider these options, don't you? Which is clearly why it's been put on the
list. That takes us dangerously into this area. You know, is it a sport or is it entertainment, or, you know, what is it? I was never a huge fan of those insane jumps. You know, the jump that nearly killed Marcus Grunnell in America. What do you call those? The crossover jumps. It's all very good and it looks spectacular, but you know, you only need a small mechanical issue with the car at precisely the wrong moment. And I know, Dom, you know this side of the sport intimately, and they do have, don't they, on those crossover jumps in America, they've got a lot of sort of padding so you don't smack into a concrete lip in the way that I think Grunnell did a few years ago.
Yeah, well, the Grunholm incident was that wasn't even on the jump. That was Toppy Häkkinen who hit the jump.
Sorry, yeah, Toppy Häkkinen. Grunholm
hit a concrete block on another part of the track. But yeah, you were right
by somebody, hadn't it? Yeah.
But you're right about the gap jump. I mean, just going slightly off topic here. At the Nitro Rallycross track in Utah, there's a depending on who you ask, there's a 100 or 120 foot gap jump. Now you look at that thing and it's terrifying. You know, I've walked to the top of it, looked down, and you know, it's really scary. But when I spoke to Travis Pastrana about it, and I'm saying, you know, this is a bit crazy, isn't it dangerous? And he said it's probably the safest part on the track. Now they do so many calculations and so much testing. And it turns out the only sort of injury that they've had on that course was from the smallest jump on the track, and that had nothing to do with the jump. There was a wide entry, too much speed, landed on the flat. But sort of to bring it back on topic, I mean, I guess if they have got rid of that rule, it will be on safety grounds. But that being said, you know, these things, to sort of bring that Nitro point back in, these things do get considered, they do get thought out. They may look dangerous and ridiculous on television. They're 9 times out of 10. In fact, that's being unfair. I mean, 100% of the time, they're completely safe, and completely, you know, taken care of before a car's even gone anywhere near it.
But we shouldn't forget that Travis Pastrana is somebody who thinks jumping the River Thames is safe and a sensible thing to do.
There is that. Yeah.
I take your point there, Dom. Actually, that is a very good point. Of course, these things are well thought out, but I think sometimes just have a small issue with where the line blurs between entertainment and sport.
We were so scathing of Formula E's gimmicks when that first started, but look at it now, it has worked. It's become a popular series in its own right, and I think part of that is down to the gimmicks. It's brought in a new audience, and maybe that is what Extreme E needs.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think you're right, and also I think it's very difficult to try and decide what sport is if it's not entertainment and pushing
the
boundaries.
Yeah, that's very true. That's a very good point, Lise. Sorry, I stand corrected
again. I think we've scratched the surface of Extreme E, but we have run out of time for this particular podcast. I think it's very important that we all get together after the first event and, yeah, find out how things thrash out in the opening round of the Extreme E Championship. If you have got any thoughts, get in touch on Twitter. We're using @DirtfishRally for now until we come up with something far more exciting Extreme E-wise. Perhaps we'll come up with some superb new word that's going to get invented over the opening round in Saudi Arabia. But for now, we've got to say thank you to Dirtfish senior staff writer David Evans. Enjoy Saudi Arabia. I have to say, pretty envious, not of you in the hotel room at the moment, but your weekend ahead.
Yeah, I think it is going to be a very entertaining weekend. And like we discussed, a real step into the unknown. And in a part of the world that I have to say I know very little about, and I'm looking forward very much to finding out an awful lot more about.
And thank you also to our motorsport, former motorsport team director, George Donaldson. George, I'm guessing you're going to be glued to every device to watch this weekend.
You better believe it. I will be absolutely doing it. Be following it. All my information will come from Dirtfish. So Dom, Anna, no pressure. I want to see good stuff coming out. And I will be watching on either BBC, Sky Sports, BT Sport or ITV, wherever I can find it. Is it available online as well?
Yeah. Yes, bound to be.
Okay.
Yes, because you've got to vote, George, that's for sure.
Oh, yes, and, of course.
And as George very adroitly said there, Dirtfish.com's Extreme Extreme E experts, Dominic Wilde and Anna Duxbury, will be keeping us up to date on the website. Thank you very much for your debut to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Really looking forward. What are you both looking forward to most about the upcoming weekend? What's wetting your whistle?
I'm just really excited to see how it's all going to come together. We've been talking about it for so long now, and we've got the drivers, we've got the location, we've got everything's finally coming together, and I'm really excited to see how it's going to turn out.
Yeah, same here. I mean, every time you go into a motorsport season, there's excitement, but whether it's the Monte Carlo Rally or the Bahrain Grand Prix or the World Rallycross season opener, wherever that may be, you kind of know what's coming to an extent. This time, there's nothing. You know, all we've got is, you know, is talk and press photos. You know, there's no precedent. I'm just really excited to see what all of this is going to result in.
Thank you very much. That's Dominic, Anna, George, David, I'm Lisa O'Sullivan. We'll be back with another episode of Spin the Rally Pod very soon.